Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
And again, I view what we do, some people, you know, call us artists. I consider actually winemaking more of a craft than an art.
Okay.
Because art, I see when my wife is working, as an example, she has this blank palette, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she's thinking, and then she's going to create something through paint on this palette. A craftsperson, has raw materials that they're working to create something.
Yes.
So that's kind of how I look at it. So I think I probably would have done something, maybe making furniture, you know, I don't know, welding something.
Sure, but something,
I think that creative
piece of it.
I couldn't imagine myself sitting in an office, you know, generating forms and you know, doing accounting or something.
Yeah.
That just, I don't have that. I don't think that way.
Yeah.
And I just think you're wired from birth.
I believe so. Yeah. So somehow the reason why it probably resonated or that pathway with you is because on some level, you know, you were self-aware and you knew that this is something that meant something to you, that ignited your passions.
Right. I wanted to make something.
That's very good.
I found wine.
Yeah. Well, and it found you, and we're all better for it.
Well, I hope so.
Trust me, I do have a long-standing relationship with the brand, meaning as a consumer, I've been fortunate enough to partake for probably a good 15 years.
Okay, great.
And I've never tasted anything that was less than stellar and interesting and enlightening, and the quality is absolutely
thank you.
Without a question.
Appreciate
always
that.
There in any vintage. So wine.
Yes.
When you started making wine, were you also developing the style? You know, as a winemaker, you clearly kind of honed your skills and your vision and your perceptions. All of that must have been creating kind of a bigger picture.
Right. So one of the things, again, being with, you know, coming into an established winery, again, the winery started in 81. I came in on 1990, and then sort of took the reins over in 98. So there was already sort of an established style.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel like it was my role to come in and radically change anything.
Mm-hmm.
I just really felt my role was to take what we had and just try to push it forward, making it better. So again, it was little changes.
Incremental, okay.
Right, as opposed to making these real giant radical changes. Because sometimes you do see winemakers come in and they, you know, it's a very radical shift. And that's not what the owners wanted. That's not what Jack Stewart had created. And it wasn't my place to come in. My name, you know, is not Miller.
Yeah.
I was just a winemaker here.
But it aligned with you. I don't think you would have participated in something that didn't.
Absolutely.
You believed in what was already there.
Yes, I believed that what Jack had established was trying to make kind of these real, you know, pure expressions of the vineyards, focusing on what the vineyard was giving us, not doing a whole lot of manipulation, so to speak, and just making these sort of pure, very elegant wines. And my role was to continue that process to make them even more refined, more elegant, if that's even a possibility. And I think we've been able to do that. I mean, I love the wines that Jack made. I think the wines that we're making now are really stellar.
Yeah.
And but Jack laid the foundation.
Yeah.
And we just Elena and I are just carrying it forward.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Stag's Leap for a moment. I know you have other properties and they're also quite notable. But Stag's Leap is such a special place.
It is.
What does it mean to you? How do you perceive this particular appellation?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, it's one of the smaller appellations of the valley, but if you look at the folks that are playing in Stag's Leap, so you have Schaefer and you have Cliff Lady and you have Pine Ridge and Clos de Vaal and Stag's Leap Wine Cellars. I mean, just to focus on, say, Clos de Vaal and Stag's Leap Wine Cellars, early practitioners of this craft. And I just think there's so much history here and appreciation for the art of making wine. And then you combine that with just the physical sort of topography and the climate here, and you've meshed sort of historical and just physical together, and it's a very, very unique situation. I really feel that the fruit that we get here is very intense in the sense of fruit component. We have really, really good structure, good acidity, where I don't find that sometimes in fruit that comes from kind of upper valley, because it's a little warmer for me. But again, that's just coming from my perspective. And you know, I kind of, you know, I have a little narrower perspective because I'm you know, accustomed to working with this fruit.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you brought Stag's Leap. It's about to celebrate a big anniversary.
Yeah, it is 30 years as a recognized appellation.
And I know there's an event in LA. I actually was fortunate enough to get an invitation to that you will be participating in, that actually celebrates.
I'm not sure if I'll be there, but somebody will be there.
The Silverado would be.
Yes, we will be there. It might be our Southern California rep, but
it's great to see that not only numerically, of course, 30 years is a big achievement, but that appellation, I call a little appellation that could. I believe that's what I've written in the past, because it really is that engine that drives a lot of the valley.
I think so.
It somehow is understated, but so powerful. And the wines are so distinct.
I agree. I mean, there's a distinction. Again, I think the fruit, there's a purity of fruit that I love. There is, you can get the fruit ripe, but it's not overripe. It's pure. And then there's like this interesting, almost like minerality to the finish, which to me a great Cabernet has. It's almost like stone or mineral.
Yes, so true. And it lends itself so naturally to age-worthiness, but what I absolutely adore about wines from Stag's Leap in general, and yours in particular, is that they're so delicious. I've been restraining myself. There's a couple bottles in front of me. John very generously opened 2011 and 2012, which we'll be tasting side by side and talking about. But I anticipate that for sure, with respect to 12, you'll be very generous with the fruit presence. And that's partly appellation and partly your winemaking. I think that's part of that philosophy that we're talking about. Because, you know, wine should be delicious. You shouldn't have to lay it down to enjoy it. Is that correct?
I agree. I totally agree. I mean, wine should be delicious. We talk about deliciousness all the time. And people don't talk about sort of just the pleasure of being a delicious wine, right? It should be a pleasurable experience. You shouldn't have to choke down your glass of wine. So yeah, we do talk about wine being delicious. That's great. You don't really hear people talking about that much.
You know, it's so unfortunate because particularly in the industry, we've become a little almost dogmatic, because we break down the flavor profiles and various technical things. But at the end of the day, it's a product of pleasure.
It really is.
And that it cannot be stated enough for my taste, because people like you that are aware of it, you know, that's part of your mindset when you make those wines. So when somebody picks up a bottle, hopefully they pick up two, because that way, or at least two, because that way they can taste something and they can, you know, have a preview of what will be coming around in the cellar should they choose to cellar it. But they don't need to lay it down first and then find out. And your portfolio actually is quite extensive. How many wines do you make?
So I don't know. I have to count. I don't know if I have enough toes and fingers. So we make a vineyard designate Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnays, a Merlot, a single vineyard Merlot, and then four versions of Cabernet. So where are we? And then Sangiovese, a rosé of Sangiovese, a Super Tuscan, which is Sangiovese Cabernet, Zinfandel, and then we do a lot of also small Bordeaux varieties. We do a small Petit Verdot, Malbec, and Cab Franc.
My goodness, it's something for everybody.
Pretty much. If you cannot find a wine that you like at Silverado, I would be shocked.
It sounds like it, and they're all very distinct and unique and true to the varietal.
Right. That's a goal for us. We really, when we're putting our wines together, when we're blending, we want to make sure that the wines are distinct, that they just don't taste like a quote-unquote red wine,
yeah.
Right? If we say it's Cab Franc, as an example, it should taste or have some semblance of what we think Cab Franc is. And so it's really important for us because, you know, this is what we do. This is our life, you know?
Yeah.
And so we words mean something.
Well, how about that?
Yeah.
Words mean something. That's, you know, it seems like such a simple comment, but to me it holds a lot of value because you do want to deliver.
Yes.
According to your own rhetoric.
Yeah. I mean, you do. I mean, we're not, you know, yeah, we're not just, you know, playing around here. I mean, if we're making a Cab Franc, we want it to taste like a Cab Franc. If we're making a Zin, we want it to taste like Zinfandel. So, just because it says on the label, we actually mean it.
that's great. And this is a state fruit, right?
Yes.
We don't purchase any fruit? Is that
well,
procured or
we,
not
we
much?
We do purchase. We've had a long-term purchase agreement with the University of UC Davis,
UC
their
Davis,
research
okay.
station. So we get about 20 tons
from
them that we bottle separate. It's called the Oakville Field Station, I think, is what we call it. And we also bottle some for the university as well. So we give that to the university. We give them a palette that they can use for tastings and events
That's
and things like
cool.
that.
You know,
well, the Millers are really, they've been very generous with the university and they really believe in the power of education. And so, like I said, we've been supporting the university through purchasing grapes since 2001.
Yeah.
So it's a really long-term relationship. And that's the only fruit that we're getting that is outside.
The rest is 100% the same, which, again, you know, pretty instructive in that of itself. There's something that you said that really caught my attention, which is you made the style of wine initially. It was established when you came on board. And then you've developed and enhanced and kind of went deeper, and it's a more nuanced, perhaps, refinement. What I find so interesting is that, unfortunately, there's trends in everything, including wine, and some wineries kind of fell victim almost to the trendy behaviors. They go from big wines to maybe wines that are less alcohol, less body, less texture, less of that, more subtle. And I've kind of watched that happen, and so have you, I'm sure. And I take a lot of heart in you saying, we stick to what we believe in. We're not trend followers.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about that. Like, where's your head at as far as that whole, you know, philosophical part of it?
Well, again, a style was defined, and it was when I came on board, the defining or how that style was defined was based on what the vineyard was giving us.
Right, exactly.
So I'm not going to change the vineyard. I mean, right? I mean, you can change a variety in there, and we have done that a little bit, trying to find some of the tweaks that we've done going forward is we are trying to find the right varieties in the right site. As an example, on our Stag's Leap property, we used to grow Chardonnay as an example. Well, it was okay Chardonnay, but it wasn't great Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. So we realized, you know, this is better for Cabernet. This is really Cabernet land. And that's when we went out and found our Carneros properties.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've pulled out blocks where we found that those varieties just aren't doing well. As an example, there's this really sort of a sweet spot on the back of our property here on our Stag's Leap property where we had Merlot. And again, it was beautiful Merlot, but we knew that Cabernet in this sweet spot was just going to be a better version of Cabernet.
Mm-hmm.
So we pulled out the Merlot and we're putting it, we're replanting Merlot, but we're putting it in a different block, in a different area mm-hmm. that we feel is more appropriate because of the soil type.
Sure.
So those are kind of the tweaks that we're making here. And mm-hmm. again, it's really letting the vineyard tell us how we should go forward rather than mm-hmm. us trying to control. We're letting the vineyard and the season say, okay, this is what you're going to do.
Well, that's a great, it's certainly a very authentic approach. And you actually already partially answered the question that I was going to ask you next. Thank you. And that is the viticultural piece of it. I know that you have a dedicated crew, which, again, to highlight, rather than hiring people every year, like a lot of vineyards
right.
do, common right. practice is to have, you know, temporary labor, or at least as an addition to the existing crew. You have a dedicated team of people mm-hmm. that the value added is that they've gotten to know this property quite
absolutely.
Well. And as a result, you know, this is a collaborative effort, is it not?
Yes. Yes. The folks at Walsh are some of the most professional folks I've worked with. The owners are spectacular. Our viticulturalist comes from a long line of family-run vineyards. They've been in the farming business, winemaking business for his family has been in that business for over 150 years.
Wow.
So he comes through it legitimately as well. Again, these guys are very smart. They have a lot of really, really smart people on staff. And again, Elena and I just kind of stand back a little bit, are in awe of what they know. We have these discussions. We taste with them when they have the time to taste. And we discuss, you know, what was successful this year? What wasn't successful? What were we looking for? They're constantly bringing in new ideas, new pieces of equipment that will help us push the quality without detracting or adding additional cost. There are always new varieties to look at, new budwood, just, you know, the trellising, just all that stuff. I mean, there's so much research going on, and all of it is hopefully, you know, and the end of the day, the idea is to make a better wine
mm-hmm.
and work efficiently and smarter, not harder, right? That expression,
yeah.
Work smarter, not harder.
Sure.
Because this industry, like a lot of industries that are so reliant on people, we're seeing less and less people doing the day-to-day work, particularly out in the vineyards.
Yeah.
So we have to be able to adapt.
Yeah.
And we have to be able to figure out at a certain quality level, what can we do to move forward?
Yeah. So you've observed the valley, you know, for decades
well, yeah.
now, and you know, both from the vantage point of your own brand, and you know what you're actively doing to, like you said, improve quality. What is the bigger picture in your mind when you look at the valley and what's been happening? What concerns you? What you take heart in?
Right. I would say what I take heart in is. People really care about this valley.
Yeah.
We, as a whole, understand that we live here, and our families are here, and we're raising our families here, and we realize it's a very, very special place, and we need to take care of it. And there's, you know, there's certainly a lot of negativity around the wine industry. You know, it's, you know, it's elitist and it's, you know, poisoning our waters and things like that. And, you know, behind some of that, there may be some truth. I don't feel that Napa really subscribes to that
mm-hmm.
because, I mean, I think about, again, my vineyard manager, he lives on site.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has children. He's not going to do anything
absolutely
to harm his family.
Yeah.
So I raised, you know, my wife and I raised our daughter here. I'm not going to do anything to hurt the drinking water in the valley.
No, I can't imagine.
So that gives me great hope. You know, there are frustrations, certainly. You see, wine, Napa wines are very expensive.
Yeah.
That is very different. I know when I was first starting here, I think our estate Cabernet was $14 or something. $14 or $15. Yeah. I mean, that was 30 years ago. But, you know, that's a little disheartening, the fact that wine is so expensive. But it is very expensive to farm here. The land
yes.
costs are ridiculous.
Yes.
We pay people very, very well. Mm-hmm. But it's hard. That's hard. It's hard to live in the valley in the sense of just because things are expensive. And that comes with just the fact that we are a world-class destination and we make a world-class product.
Absolutely, and I know you work very hard at it. And
yeah.
again, the teachable moment is that the economics and just the labor costs and everything that goes into that bottle of wine, you know, consumers have a choice to make. And
they
yes, they can buy wine from other regions, but if you want Napa wine, you want to pay attention to the brands that
yeah.
have that longevity, that dedication to not just to quality, but really, like you said, your name is on that wine, on that label, whether
yes.
it's actually spelled out, you know that it is.
Right.
And you know you're behind it, and you care so deeply.
I do.
You're so invested.
I am. it's true.
That, you know, I just wish I was fly on the wall during the blending process and such like that. That's the part that fascinates me a great deal, because for someone like you that's so hard on themselves and so demanding of excellence, I mean, for you to come up with this as perfect as it gets combination of flavor profiles, what is that like?
Wow, what is that like? When you put it that way, I just all of a sudden got a huge rush of anxiety.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just kind of look at it, I don't know. I mean, honestly, I look at it as just, it's part of what we do. It's my
yeah.
job. And I show up, and Elena shows up, and Laura shows up, and we just try to do the best that we can that day. And I don't know. It's sort of second nature. And we've been in it for so long, we just kind of just do it. And do I lose sleep at night? Yes, sometimes I do. And then you kind of make that decision, and then you just kind of have to go, okay, that's the decision, I'm done, and then you move on. And it's just kind of like any other, you know, made, crafted product. You've done it, you could keep tweaking it, but at some point you're done. It's like a painter, right?
Yes.
They put that last stroke of paint on, and they have to walk away and say, they're done. Are they happy with it? Maybe, maybe not, but they're done, and they move on to their next project.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.